Is she staying or leaving? Sources say City Manager Cheryl Long has asked Cincinnati Police Chief Teresa Thiege to resign. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, what we know about the police chief's status and the latest with the city's efforts to reduce crime. Plus, the latest with intoxicating hemp sales in Ohio, a new proposal to help child care workers pay for their own children's care, and we dive into how much water data centers are using. We turn now to WBXU local government reporter Becca Costello, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter David Ferraro. Welcome back, everybody.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Good afternoon.
So, Becca, you reported that Cincinnati City Manager Cheryl Long has asked Police Chief Teresa Thiege to resign. As of noon today, what have city officials confirmed about all that?
So no city officials, including City Manager Long, have officially confirmed that decision. So this reporting comes from folks who spoke to us, as well as our news partner at the Business Courier, on condition of anonymity. So what the city manager has said is that she recalled Chief Thiege from a work conference she was attending or was set to attend in Denver to discuss, quote, departmental matters. That was a statement on Wednesday. An updated statement yesterday on Thursday said that City Manager Long had met with Chief Thiege for what she calls productive conversations about departmental matters, has said that the city is committed to ensuring public safety, but has not addressed any of the specifics related to this decision or reported decision. We've not heard anything official from Mayor Aftab Pureville, although to be clear, it is officially the city manager's decision about hiring and firing of such positions.
David, what led up to all this? Tell us about the shooting on Fountain Square recently.
Yeah, so Monday night there was a double shooting, non-fatal on Fountain Square. Some form of verbal argument developed inside and outside, kind of going outside in of the Citybird restaurant there on Fountain Square. A gun was pulled, shots were fired. The two folks that were injured suffered minor, non-life-threatening injuries, but there was a gunman that took off. A city officer had chased another juvenile who was then arrested, but the shooter is still at large. And Chief made comments that night, again, sort of adding to context here. You have the summer of an uptick in crime and a lot of pressure. So the chief addressed that, again, reminding people that this isn't what our Fountain Square should be, followed by a press conference on Tuesday.
And you mentioned the shooter still at large. Has anybody been arrested in connection with this shooting? Wasn't there a juvenile who was arrested and somehow connected to all this?
There was a juvenile that was arrested following the shooting, but does not face any charges related to the shooting itself, just for carrying a concealed weapon. Prosecutors said in juvenile court on Tuesday morning that the juvenile stuffed a pistol into a flower box nearby and was seen on surveillance camera footage doing so.
Okay. Chris, the chief and Mayor Aftab Pureville had that joint news conference earlier this week after that shooting on Fountain Square, that double shooting that David just described. Tell us about this increased police presence that they discussed at that news conference.
Yeah, what the plan is to have the police SWAT team unit on Fountain Square, as well as another unit. And of course, there's also a plan that City Council be asked to approve to have a new youth curfew in the Fountain District. Basically, we're talking about Fountain Square and a few blocks around it. That new curfew would be for those under 18, and that would start at 6 p.m. So those are kind of the two major new measures. There's also the mayor broached the subject of diluting the number of buses going in and out of Government Square, which, of course, is just the block over east from Fountain Square, outside of kind of Fifth Third's headquarters and the federal court building.
We'll get into some of those specifics. But first, when it comes to this increased police presence, David, what did that look like on the evening of October 14th, right after the news conference? Was that increased police presence visible?
It was. I probably saw just on Fountain Square alone, not even including Government Square, just about a dozen officers, you know, just kind of keeping watch. You had the bike patrol officers, you had officers from the CDRT, the Civil Disturbance Response Team, just kind of keeping an eye on things. And you definitely saw that there was an elevated presence than there normally is on a typical night.
Did you report there was a helicopter too?
So yeah, that was what we saw. We heard reports and verified it through flight records that there was an Ohio State Highway Patrol helicopter that had done sort of just laps around the downtown area, the West End, over the Rhine and other parts of the city. Captain David Schofield, who's now the downtown commander for the central business section, had said that there was going to be an operation with State Highway Patrol as they continue to look at different ways to coordinate and collaborate.
Also during the press conference, the mayor suggested Cincinnati public schools should maybe use yellow buses instead of Metro. David, how did CPS board member Eve Bolton respond to that suggestion or that idea?
Well, Ms. Bolton was not a fan. She said that it was totally inappropriate for the city's mayor to suggest that. You know, that downtown crime is not only related to our young people. You know, the mayor made some comments during a downtown residents council meeting Tuesday night saying that, you know, obviously everything still has to be on the table, that there has to be considerations made about bringing back these yellow buses. And he had made some comments about Government Square bringing in the criminal element as sort of the hub downtown to sort of bring folks in. And it seemed like for the mayor, bringing the yellow buses back might be a solution.
Becca, this shooting at Fountain Square isn't the only shooting in that part of town that's happened this summer. Was the fact that this happened on Fountain Square part of the big concern for the mayor and for the chief?
Certainly, yes. And I will say, I think the mayor and the chief were quick to point out that there are concerns about multiple events, both shootings, and they referenced a couple of kind of violent altercations that didn't involve guns that have happened throughout the city over the last couple of weeks. So they were careful to point out that the downtown and this particular area of downtown are not their only concern. However, this is often described as the city's, you know, front porch. This is where, you know, people who don't live in the city or who live in other neighborhoods in the city come to spend their time, spend their money. The specific restrictions or rather responses to public safety that were announced at that press conference on Tuesday were very specific to Fountain Square and to Government Square, as we've talked about. The other thing that the city that the mayor has recommended is an earlier curfew. Now, there's a citywide curfew for unsupervised minors. There's also a special curfew district in all of downtown and parts of Over the Rhine that includes the banks as well as downtown and Over the Rhine that is earlier at 9 p.m. And now the mayor is proposing an even earlier curfew for just specifically Fountain Square and the several blocks surrounding it. So, you know, although the messaging has been we're concerned about crime throughout the city, there certainly has been an extra focus on this particular area in recent weeks.
David, we know we've talked about the increased police presence. I believe during that news conference, the police chief said there were officers on Fountain Square when this shooting happened. I mean, does she have concerns that that wasn't a deterrent, that this shooting happened anyway?
Well, it was a little bit yes, and I'd say a little bit no. I'd say that one of the big focuses in the press conference that both the mayor and the police chief made clear is they want officers to intervene sooner, right? And I saw that when I was actually down on Government Square Wednesday evening. They had officers that were breaking up a fight that they said was brewing. Not any violence occurring, but it just seemed like the situation might have escalated, being unruly. They detained some kids, brought them back home to their parents. And I think the chief even had mentioned on Monday night that when asked by a reporter, you know, do you need more officers? Do you think you should be adjusting the detail? She said, and I quote, I could add 5 or 10 more officers down to Fountain Square. Some people just don't care. And I think that there is a measure of, you know, a certain number of officers can be there to respond when things happen. And I do think that the police chief mentioned how having the officers there allowed them to detain some of the folks that were involved in the shooting right after it happened. Including the juvenile that was chasing to Over the Rhine, as well as one other person at the scene, which was helpful, but it cannot necessarily prevent these situations from occurring.
Chris, you referenced this earlier, but the mayor did talk about making changes to Government Square, that public transit hub just a block over from Fountain Square. Tell us more about those changes that the mayor is suggesting.
Well, we don't know much more about them. We don't really understand what the word dilute means in this respect. We had a story yesterday that he actually, before these shooting incidents, before the one that occurred most recently, he had already ordered part of Government Square, part of the Government Square bus stops, Area D, which is right in front of Fifth Third Bank's headquarters. He had ordered Metro to dilute that stop already before this high-profile shooting on Fountain Square. And what they have done is removed two bus routes, the 78 and the 21. Those are two pretty busy bus routes, and they end up skipping that stop there. So presumably, if they further ordered more dilution, that other stops would skip Government Square. This is an issue for bus riders and for Metro because Government Square, of course, is the main transfer station. So, you know, we have people who need to get maybe from, you know, the north part of the city to somewhere else. They often have to transfer through Government Square in order to get there. And so it could make their trips longer. And so I need to know that's a concern with bus riders and with Metro itself.
Chris, has the city provided any data about crime connected to Government Square or crime connected to people who ride the bus?
They really haven't. We've asked for it. There was an analysis of crime data, aggravated assaults, that Brad Thomas, who's actually a former Metro board member, has done. And he really found zero aggravated assaults on Government Square since June of 2024. You know, the thing that we're curious about specifically is whether they have linked a bunch of these shootings or assaults or whatever they're concerned about to bus riders. And we haven't received that answer yet.
Chris, you've mentioned a couple times the mayor ordering these changes. How can the mayor order this stuff to happen?
Well, the city has, so the right of way that the bus stops are located on is city property. So in the Government Square station directly in front of the the federal courthouse, that is city property. The structures, the benches, the awning and all that, that's stuff that Metro paid for, but Metro doesn't own the underlying land. So it does seem possible that the city can direct Metro about what can and can't occur on top of the streets that the city owns. And so that's the, you know, the method by which the city can act. It is interesting that the mayor himself ordered this from, you know, from his office. A lot of these types of things are administrative things that the city manager would typically do. But in this case, the letter, the email sent to Metro CEO was from the mayor himself.
Becca, you mentioned that the city's already made curfew changes. The mayor wants to make more curfew changes. Where does that stand?
What we know right now is that the announcement on Tuesday afternoon, the mayor said that he wanted council to vote on his proposed changes immediately. He seemed to indicate this was a very urgent matter. Likely it would be passed as an emergency ordinance. However, we don't have the legislation yet. I did reach out to the mayor's office this morning. I do not yet have the ordinance, the proposed ordinance. I'm not sure if it's written. I sort of expect them to leave it onto a city council agenda next week for one of the committee meetings, but it's not listed in the online system yet, and so we don't know for sure.
We started this conversation by talking about how sources have told you and Becca and you, Chris, that City Manager Cheryl Long wants the police chief to resign. Now, Chief Thigee has retained an employment lawyer. Becca, what do we know about that?
Yeah, so this is Stephen M. is an attorney with Finney Law Firm. He confirmed to us this morning that he is now representing Teresa Thigee. He declined to answer any other questions about that or about the situation. And again, we don't have confirmation from city officials yet about what these discussions that they're having with the police chief involve. However, the significant part of this is that Finney Law Firm, including attorney Stephen M. specifically, are currently representing former fire chief Michael Washington, who Cheryl Long fired in 2023. Former Fire Chief Washington, very soon after, sued the city for wrongful termination, and that lawsuit is ongoing.
Hmm. Hey, Lucy, could I
please
chip in here for a second?
Yep.
When you hire the Finney Law Firm, you are hiring them to do battle with the city of Cincinnati. That is true. And so they are aggressive in their representation. And there's also a history between the law firm's principal, Chris Finney, and Mayor Aftab Purval, pursued a number of campaign finance allegations and violations against him over the years, particularly the one that sticks out in my mind when the mayor ran, actually he was clerk of courts then, ran for Congress. I think that was in 2018. So no love lost between the Finney Law Firm and the city of Cincinnati, and going back previous administrations as well.
Hmm. Well, that is good context. Chris, speaking of context, you know, if, and we don't have confirmation yet, official confirmation from the city manager, but if the chief is fired or is forced to resign or however you want to put it, what's the track record of Cincinnati police chiefs? I mean, wasn't Chief Blackwell fired? At the time, yes. There was some criticism of low morale on the police force.
Right. This is a public spectacle similar to that situation. Those of us covering city all the time will never forget. Chief Blackwell was fired by then city manager Harry Black, and he showed up in council a few days later, presumably to speak or to make his presence known. He brought many, many dozens of supporters, and so it was quite the scene. He eventually did settle with the city. He received the financial settlement. And there's a kind of a history of this in the city in recent years.
Can you remind me what led up to that firing of Chief Blackwell? I have to confess that I do not remember. I don't know if
sure.
you remember.
I do. There were allegations abuses may be a strong word, but the way that he dealt with officers and whatnot. And, you know, going way back, though, I mean, Mayor Cranley at the time, I think he was a skeptic of the chief from going in there. I remember his text messages with then Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. He indicated there was no love lost between the two of them, him and the chief, Mayor Cranley, and the chief at that point. So it was a relationship that was not great from the get-go. Hmm.
Becca, I'm wondering what kind of support Chief Thiege has from the department. How has the Fraternal Order of Police reacted to these reports that the city manager wants the police chief to resign?
Yeah, so FOP President Ken Cobra did release a statement as these media reports were coming out about the city manager asking Thiege to resign. He falls short of directly defending the chief or her record, but does say that he believes that replacing the police chief is not the answer. His statement includes what he sees as three options for moving forward. One is to repeal Issue 5. So he says the police chief isn't under the thumb of an elected official. That's referring to a charter amendment passed in 2001 that removed civil service protection from the chief's position. It also allowed the city manager to hire a chief from outside the department. Before that, it had to be someone from inside CPD. Cobra also said that the other options to move forward would be to convince the mayor to allow the chief to do her job independently or for residents to vote a new mayor. Of course, the FOP both took a vote of no confidence in Mayor Pierval a couple of months ago and declined to endorse him in this mayor's race. They instead endorsed his Republican opponent, Corey Bowman.
Hmm. Well, and we know that it's the city manager who has the authority to fire the police chief. But David, I know the Inquirer reported that Mayor Pierval was asked multiple times at that news conference whether he supported the chief, and he didn't give a real direct answer to that, did he?
No, he did not. At the press conference, he was asked, do you have confidence in the police chief? And for the first time, he did not come out with a clear yes. All summer when he had been asked, he said, yes, I have confidence in Police Chief Teresa Thiege, but this is the first time that he kind of gave a roundabout answer to it. So we followed up with a spokesperson later in the day, and a spokesperson had said, refer to the press conference answer. And then after the Downtown Residents Council meeting, I spoke with him and I asked the mayor, do you have confidence in the police chief? Just building off the answer earlier. And he said that he has confidence in the strategies that they're implementing, but fell short of saying that he has confidence in the police chief. And when I followed up by asking, is that a yes? He said, well, I'm just going to refer back to what I just said.
Hmm. Okay. Becca, what's next with this? What are you watching for? And I'll be interested in getting your thoughts too, Chris, after Becca weighs in.
Yeah, I mean, we're waiting on any kind of official confirmation from the city about what's going on. You know, that we know from sources that the city manager has asked the chief to resign. If she refuses to resign, which it seems those are discussions that are currently happening, will the city pursue officially firing her and pushing her out? I think the timeline of that is really unclear now that Thiege has retained a representation. I think maybe we're looking at a longer timeline. I think that might lengthen things, but there's really no way to know. And then I think it's also will be really interesting to see how the city moves forward on public safety initiatives with all of this in turmoil. It seems like a pretty big distraction from, the work that needs to happen on the ground to address public safety. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out.
Anything you want to add, Chris?
I would just echo that the Finney law firm hiring, you know, this may not be settled today. I guess, you know, when a couple of days ago when we reported that Cheryl Long asked for the chief's resignation, that maybe this would be resolved by the end of the week. And so I'm not sure that's the case. The other thing I would point out is that this is really an interesting time to have this happen, you know, to take the political hack view of this. This we're 2 weeks before the election, and this kind of turmoil probably doesn't give the citizens confidence in the city government at this point.
Well, I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter David Ferrara. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, the latest on intoxicating hemp sales in Ohio. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A lot has changed over the past week when it comes to Governor Mike DeWine's ban on the sale of intoxicating hemp in Ohio. Joining me now to discuss the latest, along with other news from the State House, is Cincinnati Enquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmert. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
Always great to have you. Jesse, we talked last week about Governor Mike DeWine's executive order regarding what he did, or rather what he did and about what he calls intoxicating hemp. Can you remind us briefly what the governor did?
Yeah, so ultimately, Ohio governor's ban on intoxicating hemp lasted about 15, 16 hours, but he intended this to be a 90-day ban on intoxicating hemp, which also includes like THC-infused beverages, gummies, et cetera. He implemented this ban kind of unilaterally via an executive order because he was concerned about some of these products getting into the hands of children.
And that's because these products can look like candy packaging, right? Is that what he talked about when he announced this?
Yeah. So the governor was actually there holding up like two different packages. One was a Nerds. One was something that was like Nerdy Bears. And the colors and the marketing is just very, very similar on these particular products. Now, intoxicating hemp spans a large variety of products. And I think that was part of the criticism, is that this was a pretty far-reaching ban.
Well, you mentioned the criticism. Businesses sued over the governor's executive order. What did they argue in that lawsuit?
Yeah, so there were three specific businesses that filed a lawsuit, maybe the same day that the governor made this announcement last week, October 8th. And their argument was essentially that Governor Mike DeWine doesn't have the authority to unilaterally do this. The governor, when he initially expressed concerns about hemp back in January of 2024, had said that he needed lawmakers to act on this, that this was kind of the legislature's purview to put any regulations or restrictions or bans in place. And then really the lawmakers didn't come up with the solution. And so the governor just went ahead and did it anyway. That was one of the main concerns from these businesses. A secondary concern was also just how sweeping this particular measure is. They were concerned about loss of business, loss of ability to sell these products.
Well, you mentioned the governor asked state lawmakers to address this like a year and a half ago. Why hasn't there been any movement on this at the state house?
Yeah, there has been some movement. For example, the Senate passed a bill that would require products to be sold at dispensaries rather than breweries or corner stores, gas stations, et cetera. But that didn't get any support in the House, at least so far. Partially, this has gotten bogged down in a larger discussion about marijuana and the 2023 ballot measure that passed legalizing marijuana. But they've wanted to make some changes. We've been holding up money for host communities. And so there are quite a few things to get sorted with that 2023 amendment. And so they wanted to do this kind of intoxicating hemp regulation as part of that. And there were just too many pieces, too many arguments, and there hasn't been a lot of movement. Hmm.
How big an industry is this in Ohio when you look at these THC-infused beverages and these edible products you mentioned?
Yeah, it's hard to completely say, but there's certainly millions of dollars. Some of the businesses that filed the lawsuit kind of detailed how much product they would be out if they were to be shut down, as Governor DeWine's order would have done. And I think a number of them are just saying, you know, we're happy to follow regulations, but don't ban this entirely. When you do compare it to the marijuana industry, which is pretty heavily regulated, so much so that they filed a lawsuit about over the inability to advertise using phrases like Merry Christmas, because Christmas is a children's holiday. There's just a really stark difference between how much regulation and taxation the marijuana industry is under versus this intoxicating hemp.
You mentioned that the governor's ban didn't last long. A judge paused it. How long is this pause?
Yeah, so temporary restraining orders last 14 days. They can be extended one time before you have to do kind of a more permanent injunction. So we will see. I think it's likely that that will be extended at least once. Meanwhile, Ohio lawmakers could pass regulation, could pass restrictions on this industry. That's something that legislative leaders have said that they want to do. They want to get moving on. They see this Governor Mike DeWine's ban as kind of a wake-up call for them.
Hmm. Are there any restrictions for these THC-infused products in Kentucky or Indiana?
Yeah, so some of my colleagues looked into that, and it doesn't look like there are. Indiana bans marijuana, but these particular products, there was a 2018 federal farm bill that basically opened this up to markets and kind of created this gray market of certain products. And because there really hasn't been very much regulation at the state level, a lot of people were going forward and, you know, see this as an alternative in some instances to alcohol, which is, you know, less and less popular with certain younger people.
Hmm. Well, let's move on to something lawmakers say they want to address: the cost of childcare for childcare workers. Tell us about this new legislation.
Yeah, so this is a bill. It's a pilot program that would put $20 million towards providing free childcare for people who work in the childcare industry. I think, as a lot of people know, the cost of childcare is akin to the cost of college for many families. And part of another challenge to the childcare industry is just finding people who are willing to work in the childcare industry, because it's tough work for not very much pay. And, you know, maybe you're going to get spit up on at work, which is not a problem I have. Yeah. Most days, I would say. And so this is a way to both attract people to the field that perhaps opens up more spots for people to send their kids to childcare, and also just offsets the cost for people who are really doing the work.
Yeah, I don't have that problem at work either, but never say never. This is modeled after a program in Kentucky. How many people has the Kentucky program helped?
Let me look at the exact numbers, but it's been thousands of people so far. So the Kentucky program has been viewed as pretty successful, and I think just kind of a model that a lot of people are looking at.
Yeah,
they've helped about 2,900 families and 5,200 children last year.
Wow. Would there be a limit to the number of families who would get help in Ohio under this bill that has been introduced?
Yeah, that's one way that the Kentucky model, which is very open-ended and seems like a continuous funding stream, is different from what Ohio is proposing here. They want to set aside $20 million, and then kind of once that money is out, the program would either end, or lawmakers could take a second look at it and maybe allocate more funds to this. So this has been kind of a popular way Ohio lawmakers have been looking at these childcare solutions. Rather than just saying, let's put money towards this, they say, let's try this in a pilot program, see if it works, and then maybe invest more later.
So how would the childcare workers who get this assistance be chosen? Or would they apply for it? Do you know how that'll work? Is that laid out in the bill?
So a lot of it would be determined by the Ohio Department of Children and Youth. But yeah, they would apply and, you know, say we would like to participate in this program.
Okay. Where do these proposals stand now in the House and Senate?
Yeah, so this bill is pretty early in the process. It is was had a House hearing. There is a similar bill that was introduced in the Senate as well. So it seems like there is certainly some interest in moving this forward in House committee, especially because it's something that they're trying on a trial basis and isn't like a never-ending funding stream.
Okay, well, another piece of legislative news I want to ask you about. Democrats in the Ohio House have introduced legislation to ban fracking on certain public land. Tell us what that would do.
Yeah, so current Ohio law is that you can frack underneath state parks and state lands. This has been the case for a while, but it really didn't get moving until recently when lawmakers said, no, no, we really do want to move forward with this. And so currently, leases were approved for Salt Fork State Park, which is kind of the eastern part of the state. And so Democrats say, we really don't want to do this. We don't want to have fracking in state parks. And they also said they don't want to do it underneath Lake Erie.
Hmm. Does this bill have a shot at moving forward?
I don't think so. I think this is a conversation that we have kind of perennially, and it would be interesting to see how Ohioans at large, if this were it's not scheduled to be on a ballot, but if this is something that was put before voters, how they would feel about it, because I think there's a lot of affection for state parks and public lands, and there's some concern with fracking underneath them. But proponents of this say this is certainly money that can be infused both in the state of Ohio and in the parks. Some of the money goes back to repairs for the parks. One of the Republican lawmakers who lives near Salt Fork says you really don't see like a visible footprint from this. On the other hand, there's concerns about like a well pad explosion in the general area of the park. So there's a lot of debate about this particular issue and whether it goes forward.
Tell us a little bit more about the arguments for this proposed legislation. You talked about the people who want the fracking to happen under state land say, hey, this could infuse money into communities. What are the arguments against fracking under state land?
Yeah, it's largely environmental. One of the Democrats who proposed the bill said there's a well-documented environmental impact harming native wildlife, ecosystems, and scenic landscapes that Ohioans value. I think even the Democrats who worked on this bill said, if this is something you want to do on your private property, if you want to enter into a lease with a company that wants to do fracking or oil extraction underneath your property, certainly you have the right to do that as a private citizen. But these public lands represent about 3 to 4% of the state's total property or the total property in the state. And so maybe these are areas that we should be protecting.
Are there federal laws around all this, around, you know, fracking and under bodies of water, on parks, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I actually learned a lot about Lake Erie and oil and gas drilling this week. So there is a federal law that prevents fracking underneath the Great Lakes, and that's been in place since 2002. But interestingly, Canada, which owns half of or controls half of Lake Erie, allows drilling on the Ontario side. So it wouldn't be unprecedented to have that in Lake Erie.
Okay. What's next with this? Do you expect this legislation to get any hearings?
It will be interesting. I think there are a number of people who show up every single time there is like a land lease up for proposal at this kind of agency that makes that decision. And so there is a lot of kind of vocal opposition to fracking under state parks. And if they were allowed to have a second committee hearing, I'm certain that they would come out and make that case.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmer. Thanks so much for your time today, Jesse.
Yeah, have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too. excuse me, up next, data centers in Ohio are celebrated for creating jobs, but how much water are they using? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Ohio ranks fifth in the nation when it comes to data centers. How much of the state's water are they using? Here to dive into this issue for us is reporter and producer for the Ohio Newsroom, Kendall Crawford. Welcome back, Kendall.
Thank you so much, Lucy.
Always great to have you here. You know, Kendall, we've been hearing a lot about data centers in Ohio, how many jobs they can create. What's drawing those data centers here?
Yeah, well, a lot of communities do look at it as a good economic development opportunity to bring in a business on maybe land they didn't have anybody. But our natural resources are also a big part of why companies are even looking at Ohio to begin with. So these data centers, they require really large plots of land, and they also require lots of power and water. And a lot has been talked about the energy issue, like how we're going to take on all these new data centers coming in. But I really looked at water. Ohio, when you think about it, we have the Great Lakes, we have the Ohio River. We're very lucky and perceived with this abundance of water. But with all these data centers coming in, it's kind of been a question mark from some communities about, you know, whether we have that much abundance when we welcome in that many centers.
Right. How many data centers does the state have now?
We have 191 right now. So
wow.
Almost 200. Yes. And that's according to an online directory called the Data Center Map. And I looked back to what that number was at the start of the year in January, and it's already increased by 10% just from that time. So not only do we have a lot right now, we're seeing a lot of companies increasingly looking at Ohio for this. And when you look at the map, central Ohio has the most. It's congregated, you know, around Columbus and the suburbs and exurbs. But at the Cincinnati area, there's around 20 and that are logged in the database.
Wow. How much water do these data centers need? Do we have a clear idea of that?
Yeah, the answer is a little bit unsatisfactory there, which is that it really depends. It depends on the size of the facility. It depends on the technology that facility is using. But if we look at some of the examples, the New York Times did some reporting in Georgia that showed a Meta facility there was using 500,000 gallons a day. And then I went to the city of Marysville, and they said that one of the two data centers that they have coming online very soon is estimated to, on their worst day, use 350,000 gallons a day. So that's a little bit less. But then there was this big year-long study in Virginia that showed actually they're not using maybe that much. They're using around less than 10 million gallons a year, about the same as a large office building. So the answer is that it depends. We've seen examples of the daily estimated usage being as high as 5 million in Ohio, but there are certainly examples of data centers coming in that use a lot less than that.
We got an email from one of our listeners. Paul asks, I'm wondering if the data centers are using closed-looped cooling towers to save water.
Yes, that's a very good question. The answer is some of them are. So that's actually something that when I talked with the Data Center Coalition, they pointed out is that a lot of data centers, I mean, water is a high input cost for them. It's not, they have a lot of financial incentive to find ways to save money. And so they're looking at things like a closed loop system to try to save on that. But he did mention that, you know, a lot of times, if you do find areas to save on water and you're not using as much, maybe you're using more power, though. Mm. So it is a trade-off between like which resource you're going to maximize. But there are certainly innovations happening. There is a new center coming in New Albany that actually claims it's going to be waterless. And so definitely it's something that the companies themselves are thinking about.
You mentioned that it can be so complicated to figure out how much water these facilities are actually using. Is anybody calling for better tracking of how much water these data centers use?
Yeah, that's something that I heard from the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Their senior policy researcher, Helena Volzer, basically made the argument that water planning needs to be done regionally. And when we have data centers coming in, they're approaching maybe small towns. They're talking with those officials about how much they're willing to give or how much they can give with their population. But she says, when we think about all the different sources that we're looking at, whether it's, you know, municipal water, where they're getting that, if it's groundwater, like you, to get an understanding of how much water we have in Ohio, you have to take a bigger picture and take a step back. And so she's calling not only for data centers to disclose the water usage, and some big companies do. She's also saying they should be required to track it, because less than a third, actually, she found, do track their water usage. Mm. She wants that, and then some regional studies so we can kind of, you know, zoom out and look at how much we're using.
How are Ohio communities dealing with the needs of these businesses and the needs of their residents? Are different places taking different approaches?
Yeah, so we've seen some communities kind of push back. And it's not just the issue of water. They cite safety concerns. They cite that power question of how much energy it would use and whether the utility costs would go up. But there are two townships, one outside of Columbus area that has placed a temporary ban on data centers coming in. And then another one that's, you know, considering an outright ban in Northeast Ohio. So those are communities that are saying, wait, we need a little more information before we can make these decisions. But I spoke with Marysville, which I mentioned before. They have two data centers that are being constructed right now. And then they also have another data center that's coming in. And what they've decided is that they are going to look at the economic development, the amount of jobs that a data center brings in, and then decide how much that is worth of their water capacity. They're already giving 10% of their water capacity to data centers. So if another one comes in and says, we're only making 100 more jobs, but now you're going to have 20% of your water capacity going towards this. They're basically saying, you know, they're going to be looking harder at that and maybe putting some caps on how much data centers can use.
Yeah. Kind of a calculus problem there.
Yeah. It's a lot of math. Yeah, for sure.
Glad it's not my math to do. Well, another concern for the state is children without health insurance. How has that number grown?
Yeah. So Ohio, like a lot of other states, has seen a statistically significant increase in the number of children without health insurance from 2022 to 2024. And it's about a percentage point, a little bit more, that has raised. But it's triggered some alarm bells because Ohio historically has been very good about covering children's health insurance. We've ranked pretty high. We're still under the national average of the amount of children without health insurance, but we're seeing this trend of more and more kids are losing. So it's about 30,000 more kids.
Wow. Are other states seeing this too?
Yes. So actually we've hit a decade-long high nationwide, and that's according to a Georgetown University analysis of data. And so just from that two-year time period, there were 22 states, including Ohio, that have seen that increase.
What's the reason behind this?
Yeah, to you know, understand why we're seeing this trend, you kind of have to back up to the pandemic, which I feel like always happens.
So many things.
Exactly. But during that time, there was a federal pause on redetermining eligibility for Medicaid recipients, which basically meant that the government said, we have way too much going on right now. Like, we are not going to be, you know, determining if someone reached the threshold to not be qualified for Medicaid and then take them off. We're just going to take a pause from doing that entirely. So when the federal emergency ended, they had to do this process that's known as the Medicaid unwinding, which is taking all those people that may not qualify anymore, but that stayed on because of the pandemic, off the rolls. Health officials during that time did express concern that people who still need the coverage or still qualify might just be taking off the rolls because of procedural errors.
Paperwork and that sort of thing.
It's all paperwork, really. Yeah. And that is what we saw happen. And so children were a part of that loss.
So you mentioned that 30,000 number. How many kids total in Ohio didn't have health insurance last year?
Yeah, it was around 152,000 children in Ohio.
152,000 children.
Which, again, you know, zooming out, putting in perspective, we're still under the national average. But for a state that has long, you know, historically taken pride in our low numbers, it is, you know, something that experts are saying we need to pay more attention to this now.
Did the number of adults without health insurance increase too?
So yes, during that Medicaid unwinding period, absolutely. We saw people lose insurance. But if you look at that 2024 year alone, Joan Alker, who is with the Georgetown McCourt Center for Children and Families, said it was children that were impacted the most. Like that is what they're watching trend-wise. They're not seeing the same kind of increase in adults.
We've talked on this program about changes at the federal level with Medicaid cuts that are coming. Is this expected to get worse when those federal Medicaid cuts kick in?
Yeah, that's something that Alker said is a part of a larger storm that she sees coming. In 2027, we are seeing almost $1 trillion of cuts coming in. And so her argument is that Medicaid is super important to children. Like children, they rely on Medicaid. And you know, supporters of cuts have said this is, you know, a way to rein in federal overspending. They're just trying to remove people who aren't qualified from receiving benefits and that children, you know, won't be affected. But when you see cuts of that scale, her argument is like there is no way that children won't get some sort of harmful impact from a big scale back. Like you can try your best to protect it, but when it is a major cover of like so many children, it's very difficult.
Yeah. Well, and the kids aren't in charge of the paperwork. That's for
no,
sure.
No, they are not. No.
Yeah. We talked yesterday about Affordable Care Act enhanced tax credits. Could the end of those subsidies be a factor in all this too?
Yeah. So that's another thing. Before we even get to 2027, when we see those major cuts, there is this question right now of Affordable Care Act enhanced tax credits. And there are about 2.5 million children in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. And so that does not even compare to like the Medicaid numbers. But if we do see those enhanced tax credits run out, the Urban Institute estimates that another 450,000 children would become uninsured. And that's not just in Ohio, that's nationwide, but that's the preliminary estimates of if we see those tax credits run out.
Well, I would urge our listeners to look at your story and listen to it on WVXU.org. You do a good job of outlining other federal policies that might play a role and just the impact for kids who don't have health insurance. I mean, it's vaccinations, it's all kind of things, isn't it?
Yeah. The big thing that was the focus for Alker was if they're not getting these preventative checkups, they're not very expensive in the healthcare marketplace, but they are very frequent users of it for vaccinations and asthma. And if they don't get that care, they'll go to the emergency room and drive up costs for families and for Ohio as a whole.
Well, I've been talking with Kendall Crawford, a reporter and producer for the Ohio Newsroom. Thank you so much for your time today, Kendall.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. And if you missed all our interviews with the candidates for Cincinnati City Council, you can find those on WVXU.org. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.